gonna make any jokes about that. Hey, folks. Thanks for tuning into the BAMF podcast. This is Mike Lafferty, and this is part of our ongoing series that we are calling RPG Behind the Scenes, because we're talking to creators about RPG design, their creative process, world building. And with us today, we have one of the most respected people in the RPG sphere who was kind enough to grace us with his presence on a regular basis, Steve Kenson. How you doing, Steve?
Doing very well, Mike. Thank you. It's very kind.
No, thanks. Thanks for you give us a modicum, a patina of respectability every time you show up, and we really appreciate it.
I'm happy to help.
So let's talk about your creative process and your designing. Just to give, you know, there's a chance we have listeners who might not be familiar with your body of work, and that seems unlikely. But could you just give us a quick summation of, you know, maybe the highlights of the last few years?
So for the last few years, I have been primarily working as a staff designer with Green Ronin Publishing. So it's projects like the Expanse role-playing game, Blue Rose Romantic Fantasy, Out of the Abyss and Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide for Dungeons & Dragons, Mutants and Masterminds, and various and sundry adventure game engine or age system related products, as well as my own Icons Superpowered Role Playing that I put out through Ad Infinitum Adventures.
So, hey, Icons. did you know they're publishing fiction for the Freedomverse?
I did.
Okay. Alice and I discovered this a couple weeks ago, and we're like really big Mutants and Masterminds geeks, and we had no idea.
Well, we need to get the word out about that a little bit more effectively, I think. But yeah, Green Ronin's Nasaba Press, which is their fiction publishing and book trade print arm, is in fact doing fiction for all of Green Ronin's properties, for Mutants and Masterminds, for Blue Rose, for Freeport, and a number of other things. So there's a number of short story collections as well as some novels.
Yeah, I was excited to see that, and it was like finding a Christmas present in March. You're like, hey, we didn't know this was here. What
right?
the heck? Yeah, that was kind of cool. So, Mutants and Masterminds was a wildly popular superhero game, still is, and you were kind of the, you know, the George Washington, if you will, of that particular franchise. And kind of the legendary story is you went to Chris Pramis, I think, with the setting Freedomverse. And his response was, "I'd love to publish this if you write it for D20." Was that how that went?
Yeah, that was pretty much the size of it. Green Ronin had just gotten started, and it was the very early years of the open game license for D20 after the publication of the third edition of Dungeons and Dragons. And so the D20 market was very hot. It was really where a lot of design was going at that time. So Chris thought that was the best venue to sell a new superhero setting.
Okay, cool. Obviously you're on board with the decision to go with D20. The Freedomverse was obviously, you know, I don't want to say your baby, but your baby. Mm.
Yeah.
Did you still kind of have that, you know, sort of a feeling about that, or is it kind of grown up and gone off to college now and you're happy to see it?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of grown up and left the house in some regards, as far as that goes. You know, it was very much my pet project for the longest time, and I was basically the only person who visited. But now it's, you know, it's in the Freedom City book itself is already in its third edition. And it's seen a lot of contributors over the years who have added to it and built on it and expanded on it. So, you know, it's, you know, not to sound too grandiose about it, but it's no more still mine than the Marvel Universe still belongs to Stan Lee, you know. You know, a lot of people have contributed a lot of things since things got started. So the whole setting has grown up a lot.
I am not going to ask you any questions about fourth edition. I'm not going to do it.
Fourth edition what?
Exactly. So, well, let me ask you about you're probably the best person I can think of to ask about world building for RPGs, especially in terms of the superhero genre. Do you start with an outline, or do you just start with a couple of high notes you want to hit? Like, we want to have a Batman character, we want to have a Superman analog, or do you have maybe a more organic process, or do you think about it, you know, in those terms?
Well, for a superhero setting, I would start out with sort of a high concept of, you know, what is this setting about? You know, is this a setting that is intended to be in the style of, you know, sort of traditional comic book superheroes? And if so, you know, what kind of era and what kind of feel, you know, because there's a lot of ground to cover. You know, are you looking like the Freedom City book to create that sort of wide sense of history that covers a lot of the different eras and styles of comic books? Or are you looking to focus on a particular kind of style of comic book? Or are you looking for something else altogether that is a different kind of setting with people with superpowers who may or may not be superheroes in the traditional sense? So there are a lot of big questions to start with, you know, in terms of where you want to go.
So when you're looking at that, how do you feel the engine impacts the way that your given world would evolve? Because you've done a variety of different engines that work vastly differently. So how does that fit into the big picture questions?
Well, it depends on the, amongst other things, the breadth of powers and power levels that your setting is going to feature, and your range of different kinds of character origins and the like. You know, for example, is your superhero setting going to have to accommodate spellcasters and the Doctor Strange, Doctor Fate type characters who have, you know, real magical powers, or at least effectively real magical powers? You know, is your setting going to need to accommodate, you know, incredibly advanced technology? Is it going to need to accommodate characters who are Superman's power level, or, you know, much less than that? And those are a lot of things to take into account when you're, especially when you're going to be building a system from scratch, rather than adapting or working with or within an existing system. You know, if you wanted to do a role-playing game that was based on the early seasons of shows like CW's Arrow, you would have a very different sort of game system and game engine than you would if you were trying to work backwards from the way the CW shows are now.
Absolutely.
Featuring a lot of characters who have superpowers, who have a much wider range of power levels, and a much more sort of bent towards the sort of comic book themes. You know, so it really depends kind of heavily on, you know, the setting itself, and the kind of stories you're looking to tell.
Are you watching the CW shows?
Most of them, yeah. I'm a little behind, but...
Are you excited about this big crossover?
Oh, I'm definitely looking forward to the Crisis crossover. I think that'll be fun. It looks like a giant nerd fest.
What was that, Chuck?
I said it needs more Supermen. What are they up to, like five Supermen?
Right, like four or five at this point.
Yeah. Dean Cain is going to be in it for...
Yeah.
It is cool, the Supermans that they're pulling from other appearances in the past. It's making me kind of, you know, more excited to catch up. We're behind too, so
I hear they're trying to get the likeness rights for Steve Reeves to have him there as a hologram.
I just made that up.
No, the guy from the black and white TV show, wasn't that Steve Reeves?
That was Steve Reeves. Yeah, I think.
Yes.
George Reeves.
So you did that because Steve Kenson is really one of the Supermen. And you were trying to impose that onto them. We saw what you were doing.
You're getting all Grant Morrison over there, Walt.
Right? Very meta.
That's kind of concerning. All right, well, Steve, to get 2001 with it, I'm kind of like one of those monkeys who's looking at this great big monolith that is the Freedomverse. And I'm looking at it and gazing in awe. But I'm guessing when you wrote it, I mean, you didn't think this is going to be a heartbreaking work of staggering genius when you were, you know, writing it up on your laptop 20 years ago.
No.
You were just, you know, doing it brick by brick, you know, piece by piece. Can I ask, what was your process then when you were writing it for the, you know, writing up the setting before the first time before you even talked to Green Ronina about it?
Well, Freedom City itself started out with the city, because it was about the notion of writing a setting, specifically one that was focused around a particular city. And so Freedom City started out with a lot of influences from Pat Sweeney's San Angelo source book for Champions, which was one of the sort of early examples of a superhero city book. And Kurt Busiek's Astro City, you know, as, you know, a sort of focused city setting, as well as a lot of the sort of fictional comic book cities and real world cities that I wanted to capture elements of in the setting. So the initial design was very much about the city and what were going to be the particular features of it, you know, what were the neighborhoods going to be like, what was the history going to be like, and then kind of folding in a lot of the superhero elements that went along with that. You know, I knew that basically Freedom City was sort of an archetypally East Coast city for the most part. And so it definitely is much more New York and Boston and Philadelphia than it is, you know, Los Angeles or Seattle or, you know, any of the, you know, sort of great West Coast or Southwest cities. And then it was, you know, once the sort of basic structure of the city was in place, it was filling in a lot of superhero mythology in and around it as far as that went.
Okay. Do you have a specific... I ask this to everybody, and so far I've gotten some interesting answers, but I always, in my mind, maybe because I'm more neurotic about writing, I always think about, you know, you've got to have the right beverage, tea or coffee, maybe be in the right comfortable place. Mm-hmm. And I'm finding most of the writers I talk to on this series have a more utilitarian and pragmatic, you know, view of, you know, writing. Mm. You get thousands of words out a day, you just, you know, you do it where you can. What's your approach to, like, the physical act of creating? Do you need things just so, or you just kind of make it happen?
It tends to be kind of, you know, making it happen most of the time. Sometimes there's, you know, those occasions where it's, you know, the sort of perfectly pleasant writing day, but I usually don't have that luxury. I'm usually juggling four or five things on any given day. So writing tends to get done in chunks, and I'll say I'm going to write, you know, 1,000, 2,000 words on this, and then I'm going to move on to this other thing, and I'm going to work on that for a while, and then I'm going to do some editing, or I'm going to answer some emails, or I'm going to do some layout for an icons book, or, you know, any number of the other things that I need to be working on at any given time. It's been quite a while since when I was freelancing, I used to just write all day. And sometimes I would write all day on the same project, but that almost never happens anymore. And I just don't have the time to devote to one thing, you know, all day long, as far as that goes. So, you know, it's just getting it done in small, you know, steady increments.
Do you miss the days, you know, earlier in your career when you could have that focus more on one project, or is it?
Yeah, sometimes there's something to be said for it. You know, and it can be nice, but, you know, it's just the, you know, reality of being in the industry these days. It's rare that you have the luxury of focusing on one thing for, you know, any length of time.
What do you think, if you were starting out as a writer right now, writer, designer in the game business right now, What's the best advice you could give to somebody who was, you know, setting in with that kind of idea?
Well, I think, sorry.
I was going to make a horrible joke, and your answer is going to be more interesting. So please go ahead.
I mean, there's a lot. There's a lot of sort of unspoken assumptions about the writing business and working in the industry, and it's sometimes I've been inside it so long. Sometimes it's hard to remember the things that I take for granted because I've been doing it for such a long time. But I think if I were to give one like key piece of advice to new writers, it would be to be as communicative and forthright as possible with the editors and developers that they're working with. I know that a lot of new writers feel, sort of reluctant to ask questions or to look like they don't know what they're talking about or to admit that they have a problem or that they don't understand something. And oftentimes they'll sort of nervously just sort of hope to power on through. And that can often create more problems than it solves. And in my experience as a developer and as a designer and as a freelancer is that clear communication makes all the difference in terms of being able to address problems and being able to help a freelancer, help a writer to do their job well, because developers and editors aren't your adversaries. You know, they're your partners in this. So they want you to succeed, but they can only help if they're given the opportunity. And I know far too many writers who get started and then get in over their heads and then just ghost, or you know, they disappear or they miss a deadline or they just kind of, you know, like panic, and that just doesn't serve anyone as far as that goes.
You see that on Kickstarters all the time. Even known names end mm-hmm. up ghosting out on projects.
Yeah.
For those of our viewers that don't know your breadth of experience, how long have you been writing for RPGs freelance and then going into these big names?
It will be, I have to do the math. It's like 24 years now. I first started working in the industry in the mid-90s. And it turns out that the mid-90s were well over 20 years ago now, which I'm still not on board with, but that's the way it is.
That's fake news.
Yeah, sorry. Right. I'm against it. But
well,
you
Walt
know.
Did say that you are, you know, eternally young. So, you know, give people an idea of just how eternal you are.
Oh, I'm 50. If that makes a difference.
That's not what I meant. But how eternal in the industry?
In the industry,
is what I meant. Yes.
Yeah. I didn't want to ask you. Are you inferring that Steve occasionally has to sword fight strange people?
Possibly, yes. One. There can only be one. So,
I was wondering, at what point when you're coming up with a new property or what have you, and you're working through your design process, do you say this really needs its own system? Because with the mm-hmm. breadth of systems that we have out there that cover a wide variety of play styles, when do you get that spark that says, you know, what's out there isn't going to accurately convey what the stories I really want people to experience? Mm-hmm. When do you come up with that?
Well, it depends on the project, you know, like a lot of things, and it depends on the options that are open to us as far as that goes. To use one example, when Green Ronin got the license for A Song of Ice and Fire, the Game of Thrones series, to do an RPG, we had a high-level, you know, sort of production meeting to talk about it and, you know, the directions we would go in it. And I definitely made a case for the notion that it needed its own system in order to do the game well. partly because there had already been a previous D20 iteration of the setting when Guardians of Order had the license before us. And we didn't want to just simply redo that. And in addition, I didn't really think that the D20 system was the kind of style that we wanted for gameplay in the setting, because it was too D&D. And you know, Game of Thrones, in spite of the outward trappings, is in many ways the exact opposite of D&D. So we decided to go with what eventually became called the Chronicle system that we designed for Song of Ice and Fire in order to capture certain elements of the books in gameplay.
That brings up an interesting question for me. Everybody in this channel has already played a ton of different systems, but I know a lot of people that have only played one or two systems. What can you tell those people about how a system can impact the flavor of the game? Because some people say, I can play any setting mm-hmm. with D&D, and it's true, but sure. What would, you know? Go.
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, there is very much a school of thought that says system doesn't matter. And that it's all about narrative. But of course the system does influence the narrative because in many ways narrative is what comes out of the game as you play it. And different systems will, you know, lead to different outcomes or even just emphasize different elements of the gameplay and the story in different ways. For example, the Chronicle system for Song of Ice and Fire has an explicit, what we called an intrigue system, where there are game mechanics for being sneaky and coming up with plans and convincing people to do things, and all of those kinds of behind the scenes sort of courtroom intrigues that go on in the stories. Dungeons and Dragons doesn't, as a general rule, have a system for that. Most of those social interactions are largely role-playing and a few ability checks that may come into play for the most part. And that's because that's not the style of game that Dungeons & Dragons particularly focuses on. And so the very fact that there is an intrigue system in the game says kind of implicitly, you can play a character whose area of specialty is being sneaky and clever and convincing people of things. And the game will support that. Rather than saying, well, I want to play that character, but the game doesn't really give me any way of approaching that, of sort of entering into that in the game session, apart from just sort of making stuff up and saying, well, you know, I do this.
And that brings me to another question that I like asking a bunch of developers, which is, how do you see probability of dice factoring in for that, because every engine uses a different style of dice mechanic and such like that, mm-hmm. and they all have different theories on probability influence.
Sure. Well, you know, probability is a matter of the dice or other randomizers are all about those decision points in the game of what direction do things go in. They're partly about, you know, sort of randomizing narrative, you know, of, you know, do the characters go left or right, so to speak, you know, what path does the story follow depending on whether they succeed or fail. And ideally you find ways to make success and failure either equally interesting or at the very least equally able to advance the story in some way. And the mechanics also serve to create dramatic tension in the game. You know, the possibility of failure and the possibility of spectacular, unexpected success are things that add energy and add excitement to gameplay. And it's part of the reason people, you know, enjoy and play games is there's an element of, I mean, there's an element of risk. There's an element of gambling to it. So, you know, the excitement of, you know, like the having a critical hit rule where, you know, a particularly really good die roll or combination is going to have some spectacular result in game, you know, can lead to, you know, a lot of, you know, really great moments. Especially when that you have that sort of, you know, right conjunction of, you know, that perfect die roll at the perfect time that, you know, everybody is just talking about after the game of, can you believe that? You know, it was just like that last minute success was amazing. And some of that you try to build into the system as an as potential, essentially. You can't manufacture that kind of thing exactly, because you can't guarantee that, you know, the perfect die roll is going to happen at the perfect time. And if you could, there wouldn't be any dramatic tension because you know it was coming as far as that goes. So you just try and build in the potential for that with the awareness that there are going to be some games that aren't going to necessarily catch fire that way, you know, and as far as it goes, and some of it is sort of the law of averages.
Is that a frustration as a game designer? I mean, there's so much blood, sweat, and tears into the product and the setting,
mm-hmm.
but ultimately how most people interact with your work is going to be through the intermediary of a GM and what mm-hmm. happens at the table. Is that is that something you accept and you know that's the medium I'm working in, or is that something you kind of, you know, push against? Because
I mean, that's, you know, it's common wisdom in tabletop role-playing games that whoever cracks the code of being able to include a fantastic game master with every book that ships is going to, you know, make $1 million because that's going to be the, you know, the next great, you know, killer app of gaming, is if you can figure out how to automatically make whoever runs the game an awesome game master. And there's tons of different schools of thought. You know, I mean, I've written endless chapters of game master advice, and there are endless books of game master advice and tools to help make game mastering easier, and ideas about how transparent the game master process should be and whether or not you even need a game master for tabletop role playing. And there have been a lot of indie approaches to trying to do away with the game master to one degree or another, you know, and reduce or eliminate the game master's role and make things more collaborative. And, you know, I think that all of the various approaches have their merits, but it does really come down to having the right game group. I think sometimes a little too much emphasis gets placed on the game master, whose role is important. But I'm not sure a great game master can still run a great game with a group of terrible players.
No.
You know, I think that the whole group has to be on the same page of making a great game for it to really work out.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think game masters often there's a lot of hand wringing about mm-hmm. the dungeon master ruining the special snowflake of you know, the RPG designers' blood, sweat, and tears. But when you walk into game stores, I watch game masters that I think are objectively bad, but they have 8 people crowding around a table who are all mm-hmm. enjoying themselves and who would, you know, walk to the game if their car broke down. And so obviously this guy's got something going on, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Different people look for different things in their game masters. I know that I disagree with some of the game advice that I see out there. Like there was one really big article that was circulating that said that a GM should be talking 75% of the time. And I'm like, no, if I'm talking 75% of the time, I'm narrating a play. I'm not GMing anymore.
Right. I tend to agree.
There's a lot of different opinions.
There are a lot of schools of thought, you know, about what even constitutes being a good game master. I agree. I've seen game master advice that I disagree with. And I wouldn't game master that way, but people do.
And linking that back to game design, same thing. There's tons of different game systems and designs out there with different narratives, beliefs, and premises. And you just got to pick the ones you like and go with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I mean, and game design is as much art as it is anything else. So like all art, it's very subjective.
Yes. And that's something I love watching a creator like yourself GMing the game they created, because it's a very different experience than giving it to somebody else to GM, because they have this universe inside their heads that you can't reproduce with a new GM.
How's the collaboration between a designer and, say, a group of playtesters? Do you have a set group of playtesters, or do you use different groups to help you with different properties? I know several people who say they write and they produce content for the game industry, but yet they don't play anymore, and that always shocks me. And it's like how do you feel? Alice is jumping up and down like. Can you talk a little bit about the playtest and how important that is to your design process?
It is important, and ideally, you know, every design should be playtested. You know, unfortunately, the realities of publishing in the game industry are such that that's not always the case. In fact, I'm not even sure it's often the case. You know, ideally, every design should be playtested as much as reasonably possible, because there's a whole world of difference between the written page and the game table experience. And you know what Alice was talking about you know, seeing designers run their designs. One of the important things about the playtesting process is, does this work the way I envisioned it in my head? You know, because, you know, I understand how it works because I, you know, came up with it, but can I adequately explain how it works to other people in such a way that they can grasp it and, you know, use it easily? To give you one example, when I originally did the design for Icons, I discovered after the first edition was published with Adamant Entertainment, the more I ran Icons, the game was originally designed so that the game master didn't need to roll dice. The players made all the rolls. The game master was only working with fixed difficulty numbers, essentially. To my mind, that freed up the game master to be able to focus on managing other things, because, you know, especially when GMs are running, you know, a fight with six superheroes and, you know, a team of supervillains, and the GM has like six characters to keep track of, and each player only has to keep track of their own. You know, it's a bit of a gang up. But the more and more I got feedback from people who played the game masters hated not rolling dice. You know, it really bothered a lot of people, you know, and it was a problem. You know, I mean, it wasn't anything mechanically unsound. In fact, the adjustment I made basically simply
very, very subtle, because you just took the negative die and gave it to the GM.
But it's still the
same mechanic of positive and negative die. You just said GM can roll the negative die now. Now you're happy?
Yes. That's pretty much exactly what I did, was GMs, you can roll this die. Are you happy now?
Yep.
And they were like, yes. thank you. Like, I just want to roll a die.
Yeah, it's just so subtle. It actually came up in the video that somebody posted in comments that they thought we did it wrong, so we explained it a little better, mm-hmm. a little bit more in text, because, like you said, can you adequately explain that to your audience?
Right. Right.
And I noticed that subtle difference, and it makes me giggle and laugh every time.
Yep. Yeah, mathematically, it's exactly the same, but it feels different. And, you know, that bit of feel made a big difference for a lot of people, where they were like, oh, this is much better. You know?
I was reading a Twitter thread today. Someone was talking about the difference between having a clock in game design and having a track. Mm-hmm. And once again, exactly the same thing. You're going through so many steps to get to a result, and the guys, you know, the conversation kind of came up with, people just like clocks better. It makes you feel more urgent. And someone said, well, game design is 90% layout.
Mm-hmm. Clocks
also feel less linear to a lot of people for some reason than tracks. And yeah. I'm like, you do know the math behind that, right? It's exactly the same linear level, mm-hmm. but it feels less linear, and therefore that's all it takes.
Yep.
Perception is 80% of it.
How things feel is a big deal. And honestly, that's where playtesting comes in, because mm-hmm. you're only going to know how things feel at the game table when you actually get it in front of a group of players and you get it into their hands and they get to go, oh, this is really cool, or this feels weird. I don't know if I like this kind of a thing as far as that goes.
Have you ever had one group that said, yes, this is amazing, and the other group that said, no, we can't do this?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, and you'll get different, because again, it's subjective. And you will definitely get groups that are like, oh, I hate this kind of thing. And you will get other groups who are like, we love this kind of thing. And sometimes it just comes down to, you know, being a design choice and saying, well, I think this thing works better, so I'm going to go with this.
Anyone else notice how Chuck was so quick to say no when we talked about you can't have a good game with bad players?
Yes. Chuck's been very quiet other than that.
Was there some experience behind that, Chuck?
I just think, again, I think that the emphasis on the Game Master is very overstated. It's I think, a result of the fact that our hobby was basically created that way. When you think about the cult of Gary Gygax, right? And that is sort of how people have decided it has to be. But in fact, it's very collaborative. And I think Gary would be the first one to say that, you know, that his players were of huge import in how great his early games were. And so, yeah, I've been in situations where you're just looking at a table that for whatever reason is dead, and you're just like, so what do you guys want to do? And there's no feedback. And so, you know, I've canceled games. I've just been like, okay, obviously we just need to put the books down and drink or watch a movie or, you know, mm-hmm. something, because it's not happening tonight. You absolutely need players.
Yeah, that actually brings me to an interesting question on design for Steve. So we were just talking about the way that narrative works, and you brought up some interesting points that make me wonder, how do you perceive the influences of miniature board, digital, and storytelling gaming put together? Because there's a lot of changes. Everybody's like, oh, we want to try mm-hmm. and make it more like a video game or more like a war game or more like a board game. How do you see that influencing most of the projects you do?
Not a great deal for the most part. I think that you do definitely see some influence coming back in from board games and video games on RPGs in terms of design elements in some places, you know, mostly in the sense of defining character roles and sort of game spaces as far as that goes. And I think that story games are probably one of the bigger influences on RPGs, just because they are, you know, essentially narrative. in their structure. It's always been with RPGs striking that balance between it's a game and games have rules, versus the sort of, well, let's just all get together and collaboratively make up a story. And what are the guidelines to that going to be? You know, essentially just sort of improv. Games sort of run on a, RPGs tend to run on a continuum, you know, in terms of, you know, is this strictly a board game, you know, where we're just moving pieces, abstract pieces around a board, and, you know, the story, you know, doesn't matter any more than, you know, saying we're a real estate developers playing Monopoly, versus, you know, what's my Monopoly character's backstory? You know, what's my motivation here? Versus the sort of purely, we're just going to make up a story. There aren't any rules to it, as far as that goes. And, you know, it's often the sort of childhood example of the, you know, well, I shot you. Well, no, you didn't. You know, well, yeah, I did. No, you didn't. You know, and that's why we have rules, as far as that goes. So I think that that's the sort of the big influences. It's interesting to see how, for example, fourth edition Dungeons and Dragons took a lot of inspiration from miniatures, wargaming and board game design in a lot of their game design.
Too much.
Opinion of some people.
yes.
But it's interesting to see how some of those elements have found their way and still remain elements of the fifth edition of the game. And a number of innovations from fourth edition still, fifth edition wouldn't be what it was without some of the innovations from fourth, as far as that goes.
And like you said, it's very subjective. I know a number of people that believe that Powered by the Apocalypse feels very board game-ish because you're mm-hmm. choosing moves, and right. therefore it gets in the way of the narrative. And then there are other people that think that that is the most narrative system out there. So absolutely. It's very, very subjective.
Yep, it is. It's very subjective. And again, it's some of it is that entry point, you know, of the game. And Powered by the Apocalypse games are a good example of this, where the game itself invites you to look at certain opportunities by codifying certain things in the narrative as moves. The game says, hey, we expect that you might want to do this, and we're showing you how you can do it, that this thing is potentially important. Because games, RPGs by their very definition, can't codify everything. Every possible thing that players could come up with just can't be codified. So the game has to selectively focus on the things that it thinks are important. And moves are one way of saying, hey, we think these things are potentially important. It opens up a lot of opportunities for players to go, oh, I didn't know that I could make that thing important, because it doesn't involve combat necessarily, which is a lot of what role-playing games tend to still emphasize, is it's, you know, there'll be a huge chapter on how to fight and kill things.
Well, I would like to keep on talking. Unfortunately, real life intrudes and I have to go pick up my kid from school. Do we have any closing thoughts, closing questions from anyone before we wrap things up?
What game are you playing now? Or do you, as a designer, are you so busy you don't get to play anymore?
I do. I still have a regular gaming group. Most of my friends from college are still gaming together.
That's awesome.
I know, right? Right now, we are, a friend of mine is running Mutants and Masterminds, which is fun for me.
I've heard of that one.
What's that?
Is that something new? I haven't heard of that one. What is that?
Mutants and Masterminds. Yeah, it's, you know, it's not going to last.
It's a small little indie game. That's just a phase.
I am running the Rise of Tiamat campaign for D&D.
Nice.
so which has been fun.
Do you have, you've worked on a lot of the more popular licensed properties in the last few years. Is there a dream project out there somewhere you'd still like to get your hands on, or maybe kind of sell those itches?
Well, there's, the cool thing about licenses is there's more new stuff coming along all the time. If, say, there was an opportunity to work on an RPG for the Dragon Prince animated series for Netflix, I could be persuaded. that's a really great show, and I would love to do something with that. There's all sorts of new stuff coming along all the time. So I'm lucky that I've gotten to do a number of my RPG dream projects, these days. I think because of the new trailers coming out of CBS All Access, too, I'm feeling the itch for doing something with Star Trek again, because I'm a big Trekkie, and I worked on a couple different Star Trek RPGs at different points. So, but I haven't had anything to do with the current one these days.
Yeah, did you not work on The Last Unicorn?
I did. I was a staff writer for Last Unicorn.
That was very good.
A ton of stuff for that.
It's odd how some of the RPG material from previous RPGs for Trek has kind of worked its way into the canon.
It is, actually. Yeah. I understand a lot of the, especially a lot of the Andorian sourcebook stuff found its way into Trek canon and during Enterprise.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of cool. It's just unexpected. It's, Paramount goes as far as making it clear they don't consider the novels to be canon.
Mm-hmm.
And then, our RPGs, some people might see them as the redheaded stepchild when you compare it to novels. And, to have that stuff, kind of shoehorned into the canon. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, it is.
Well, hey, unfortunately, I have to wrap things up. Anyone else, closing thoughts, closing questions? Chuck, Ellis, Walt,
Steve? I would just say, Steve, thanks for coming out. It's always a pleasure to have you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming out.
It's always great. Thank you very much. And to our listeners, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Banff Podcast. And I'll hit the end broadcast button, and it always takes way too long to actually...